Hello, I'm Stephen McKinney-Steck for Carol McKinney Foundation for Public Media. Welcome to this first edition of what we title Heard in Central Florida. This series is another step in CMF's mission to reflect local issues and voices that matter, and to do so in a manner that may not otherwise be available from local mainstream electronic media in a sustained or a substantial form. While this online series is a presentation of CMF Public Media, what you'll hear in a moment is a production of an important local civic organization with whom CMF is privileged to collaborate, the Seminole County, Florida League of Women Voters. In just a moment, you'll hear the League's recent Hot Topics luncheon program on the subject of youth substance abuse. Collaborating together in this manner broadens the League's reach, advances your awareness of this and other critical subjects, and extends CMF Public Media's commitment to issues and voices that matter in Central Florida.
I'm Deanna Schott, President of the League of Women Voters of Seminole County. I'd like to thank the Carol McKinney Foundation for recording this program. The League of Women Voters of Seminole County is a nonpartisan political organization which encouraged informed and active participation in government, works to increase understanding of major public policy issues, and influences public policy through education and advocacy. We are pleased to present this Hot Topic luncheon as a medium to educate you on issues of importance to those who reside in Seminole County. These programs are held monthly on the fourth Thursday of the month at Sergio's Italian Restaurant in Sanford, located on 1792, just north of the 417. The program presented here focuses on the problem of teen substance abuse, its effect on our students, teachers, health, and safety personnel. Our panel of experts stand ready to help you understand how they deal with this problem and how you can get some help should the need arise. We encourage you to explore the CMF website, which contains interesting and useful information, such as biographies of the speakers, links to related content, and pictures of the event. Please join us now as Jane Lane, Vice President of the League, introduces our program.
Welcome to the League of Women Voters Hot Topic, and our topic today is substance abuse. The League of Women Voters' main job is education. And Stephanie Schott has risen to the occasion, particularly with substance abuse. Stephanie is one of our youngest and one of our newest members. And as soon as she paid her check and came on board, she said, let's study juvenile justice. Stephanie, my pleasure is to introduce you.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Schott, and I am the chair of the Juvenile Justice for the League of Women Voters. When I joined the League of Women Voters in the spring, the first thing I asked the board was to update the juvenile justice system in Seminole County. This program is a result of that request. The juvenile justice system was completely changed in the 1995 state legislature. Juvenile justice was taken out of the jurisdiction of the Department of Health and Rehabilitation Services and made a separate Department of Juvenile Justice. The League of Women Voters of Florida's position is to support a juvenile justice system that encourages prevention and diversion and recognizes the special concerns of children and their families. Serving as the program moderator today is Wayne Weinberg, who is the Executive Director of Leadership Seminole. He has served as the Director of Development for the College of Engineering and Computer Science at the University of Central Florida. Wayne also served as the director of Seminole County Chamber of Commerce, was a broadcast journalist, and served as the morning news anchor on WDBO. Through all of his professional career and his community activities, Mr. Weinberg has been a strong youth advocate. Mr. Weinberg?
I'm here. Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you all for being here today on a subject that's serious to all of us. And before we go on, and I introduce our panelists, I'd like to share some current data that is related to what we're to talk about. And we're talking about impact on young people, so I wanted to give you this current information. There's an organization called NOPE Task Force in which this community is engaged in. Jeannie Morris recognizes that right away. I was at Hagerty High for that presentation today. I walked into an auditorium filled with juniors. It's Hagerty High. You know, it had a very funeralistic or haunted house feeling with the type of music that was being pumped in. And all across the stage, blown up in big posters, were young people who had died of drug abuse. And during this whole hour, we heard stories about from family of what it was like, and there was a demonstration from an officer who was at the crime scene of a death of a young person who died of drug overdose in Oviedo, who actually rolled out a body bag and then took the microphone and had it right at the zipper as it was being closed. And I will tell you, this had a profound effect on these young people, and hopefully it'll work. They had two presentations, and then there's some other presentations that will occur through the high schools throughout Seminole County. I think this was a good compliment. I'm not sure, but I heard one student remark as it was over, "My day is now ruined." So hopefully by seeing this very graphic material, and by the way, this is one of the pamphlets, and here you see an actual victim on the slab. I mean, they didn't hold any punches. It was a cold, cruel reality. With the thought is, just one time could kill you, was the message. Item number two, the Seminole County Youth Commission, involved with the East Central Health Council, launched a scientific study of the most pressing issues facing high school students in Seminole County. It was an internet-secured survey. More than 7,000 students voted, and they identified among the top areas drug abuse. There were three other areas, which include body image, conflict resolution, and depression. But 38.4 of all the students who responded said that drug use is a serious problem in the Seminole County school system. And this is not an indictment of the Seminole County school system. If you pull them in Orange or anywhere, I guarantee you it will mirror the results. 65.5% of these students had tried alcohol in their lifetime. 38% of the high school students had used alcohol in the past 30 days. And they say alcohol was their most commonly used drug. 22% have tried marijuana at least once in their lifetime. And ecstasy is the most commonly used club drug, among Seminole County teens. The NOPE organization also tackles, I should say, death by overprescription of drugs, which has become a very serious problem. And I'm sure our panel would collaborate on that as well. So, What I'd like to do now, if I may, is introduce our panel and also go into our standard questions or predetermined questions, and then we'll allow you to share questions as well. And again, panelists, if you would come up to the microphone here, that would be extremely helpful. Circuit Judge Nancy Alley, received her law degree from Villanova School of Law. She has worked for the IRS, has been in private practice, and an adjunct professor at Barry University of Law School. Her judicial background includes serving in probate, juvenile, civil, and criminal divisions. She was elected Circuit Judge 18th Judicial Circuit in 97, re-elected in 02. Among her many professional honors, excellence in justice, Seminole County Bar Association Jurist of the Year, Seminole County Bar Association Philanthropist of the Year, distinguished service as juvenile judge and professional award. Please welcome Nancy Alley to our panel. Very good. Steve Barnes. Steve Barnes is vice chair of the Seminole Soil and Water Conservation District. I know what you're thinking. Why is he here? Is he planting marijuana? I don't think so. As a teen, Steve was arrested on a minor drug charge. He became entangled in the juvenile justice system. He was able to turn his life around with the help of a unique program and will share that experience and ideas for helping teens overcome their problems and become productive citizens. Please welcome Mr. Steve Barnes. Let's see, Dawn Cartwright. Now, she must be very modest because she submitted the shortest bio. Simply graduated from Thomas M. Cooley Law School, been an assistant state attorney in Seminole County in the juvenile division since May 2000. I will make the assumption on your as a compliment that you were too busy working the division to provide us with a more in-depth endorsed bio. Okay, will you go with that? All right, investigator Deputy Daniel Camargo. Over here, I'm sorry. Thank you. Currently assigned as a gang detective, 8 years law enforcement experience, 5 with the Sanford Police Department, the last 3 with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office. In his 8-year career, he has worked as a patrolman, a homicide investigator, and an undercover officer. I think you're in the right stage to prepare your own book right now with all this background. He was an Olympic hopeful, that's very cool, for the 1996 Games in Atlanta, and now coaches at a local high school in his off-duty time. He is in constant contact with local youth as both gang investigator and coach. He also has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. If we'd welcome the deputy, please. Okay. Now, you may have to do your own. Todd, you may have to. Oh, here's Todd's bio. Investigator Todd Modderson has been in law enforcement for 16 years, 11 in the Seminole County Sheriff's Office. During his tenure at the Sheriff's Office, his assignments have included Road Patrol, Police Athletic League, Intensive Community Service Unit, Intelligence Unit, most recently the Gang Intelligence Unit and Suppression Unit. He's also a member of the Sheriff's Office Disaster Response Team. Professor Association membership includes Florida Intelligence Unit, Florida Gang Investigators Association, and East Coast Gang Investigators Association. Please welcome Investigator Todd Modderson. First question, and that goes to Todd. And our question, Todd, that we'd like you to answer is, what is the function of the JAC and JD centers?
On behalf of Sheriff Essling, we appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak to you today. The JAC, or the Juvenile Assessment Center, also known as the JAC, there's a few ways that a youthful offender can enter into the JAC. One of the ways is through truancy to the non-secure side, by skipping school, basically. They can enter through the secure side. They're entered into a little classroom area and given some instruction there. Another way is through the secure side, which is the they have some cells in there. Let's say a juvenile is arrested for drug-related offenses or any type of criminal act. They're brought into that secure side of the facility, and they're assessed by the Department of Juvenile Justice based on their offense. And they're kind of a point system, depending on what their history is, what the current offense was. There's a couple things that may happen to that youthful offender. They may be sent home that day to their parents. They could be sent over to the Juvenile Detention Center, or JDC, that's run by the Department of Juvenile Justice. Another way that a youthful offender could get into the Juvenile Assessment Center is if they're a runaway. They don't receive any criminal charges. They're brought there kind of a safekeeping or a safe harbor place until their parents can come pick them up. Also, if there's a child and youth in need of services, they might, let's say they're found wandering the streets at 3 o'clock in the morning. They can't get a hold of a parent. The officer deputy can't get a hold of a parent. They would be transported to the Juvenile Assessment Center and held again as a safe place for them until they can get a hold of a parent or guardian. In the event they can't get a hold of a parent or guardian, they may be turned over to a program such as Boys and Girls Town, something like that. There's also programs or services that are offered through the Juvenile Assessment Center to youth. The Department of Juvenile Justice does a great job of interviewing the children, identifying needs, and things like that. Also, they talk to the parents, try to find out how they can maybe help the juvenile and the parents head in the right direction. And that's kind of covers the Juvenile Assessment Center. The Juvenile Detention Center, if a child, maybe a serious habitual offender, is rearrested, or maybe they're on probation, they're arrested for a violation of probation or home detention, they may be sent over to the Juvenile Detention Center to be supervised by the Department of Juvenile Justice. They would have court the following day, and the judge then, and Judge Al would probably speak a little bit better on that side of things, but they would have court the next day, and there would be determination whether they're released to the parent that day or whether they're held insecure detention for a period up to, I believe it's 21 days. So that's kind of the quick peek at the Juvenile Assessment Center, which is, again, run through a partnership with the Sheriff's Office and Department of Juvenile Justice, as well as the Juvenile Detention Center, which is run by the Department of Juvenile Justice.
You may applaud. Thank you, Todd. All right, here's I would call a combined law and order question for our prosecutor, Dawn Cartwright. Dawn, what criteria do you use to decide if a young person is offered rehab as opposed to jail?
As far as rehab, I noticed the title of this was Youth Substance Abuse, Rehab or Jail. First off, I wanted to clear up that juveniles don't go to jail. They go to the detention center, and that is something totally different. Now, there's something called a risk assessment instrument that you heard Investigator Motorson talking about the JAC Center, where the Department of Juvenile Justice has probation officers that will sit down and talk with the juveniles when they're arrested for a charge, perhaps a possession of marijuana charge, less than 20, which is a misdemeanor. They will sit there and they will talk to them, and they will then score them. The risk assessment instrument is basically a score sheet, which I handed out earlier. There are two parts to this score sheet. The first part asks certain questions. You have to get a yes answer to even continue on to the second page, okay, which is the actual scoring part. Just for an example, a possession of marijuana charge, a first-time offender, will never get to the second page. They will never go past the first page, the qualifiers. They will be released to a parent with a notice to appear for a court date, what we call an arraignment date. Okay, they have to score certain points, and say other charges come in that may get past the qualifiers, you still have to get to the score sheet, and you have to score at least 12 points to be in secure detention. 7 to 11 points scores what we call home detention, where they are basically at home, they can do nothing but go to school and then come back home again and work also if they do that. And anything under 7, they're released outright. So most juveniles, first offenders, will be released with a court date to show up for an arraignment date. And that is how, and if they do score 12, then they have to be seen by a judge, a juvenile judge, the next day. Then judge will make the decision as far as whether he wants to keep them in secure detention or whether he releases them to a parent with certain conditions. And that depends on each individual case. So I hope that answers the question on that.
Thank you. And next question is for Judge Alley. Judge Alley, what do you do differently when a parent does not want the child in their home and just wants them arrested?
I get out the handcuffs. What I have are several different situations where this comes up. One of the major ones is some domestic violence at home, which can often be related to drug issues, not necessarily, but it can often be related to them. And Junior wants to go out and take the family car and go party, and Mom stands in the door and says, "You can't go." And Junior picks up the mom and moves her to the side and walks out the door, and that's technically domestic violence. Okay, we know there's a lot more problems there. And with juvenile, there's usually a lot more problems. It's not just drugs, it's often a mental health issue or some family dysfunctional issue. So there's a lot of things that are going on. And a lot of times the violence is a lot more severe than that, and the parent says, "I don't want him back in the home." If there's a sufficient justification and they still don't qualify for the juvenile detention center as far as points, then we can consider the child has been abandoned by the parent and call the Department of Children and Families, not Department of Juvenile Justice. It's a whole separate department for abused, abandoned, and neglected children. And if you're leaving your children to the state to handle, that's abandonment. Sometimes when the parents hear that, they say, "Oh, no, I'll take them home." Sometimes they score detention, but I really don't think they need to be in detention. When she said they score 12, but I've seen them the next day, and I'm going like, this is not really a kid that we need to take out of school and put into the school system for the detention, which is a different system. Some of these kids are very, very bright, and this kind of thing can really hurt them academically. So some of those kids, I'll just remind the parent that they have to pay $50 a day for every day their child's in detention. And sometimes that makes them want to take their child home. Or they know an aunt or a sister or a grandparent that will take the child home that'll have a different thing. So, yes, I manipulate them a little bit to seeing the other reality because they're focused on their reality of what it happened at home. Sometimes they're focused on the correct thing. They're not safe to take this child home. There are other children that make it not safe. There's other good reasons why that can be an issue. And I have to listen to the parents, but I also am there for the kids. The kids are the person that's the defendant in that case. So those are the main issues I look at, and that can be as varied as the number of people in this room. So that's why we have to have hearings in front of judge to deal with the individual facts. And we can't just do it by a risk assessment sheet alone. Hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Judge Alley. Our next question is for Deputy Camargo. And the question for you, sir, is, are most minors arrested repeat offenders as adults?
So the question is, are most juveniles who are arrested repeat offenders as adults? In my experience, I'd have to say not necessarily. The majority of the juveniles that get arrested are arrested for a broad range of charges, not necessarily drug-related. There's a lot of criminal mischief, which was known as vandalism not too long ago. That was a term used often. batteries, assaults, getting into fights, thefts, shoplifting, those sort of things. The majority of kids who are arrested, whether they learn from the justice system that that's not the way to go, or they just suffered so much of a loss, maybe they got suspended from school, kicked out of school, or what have you, they fly straight and go on to college and live very legitimate lives. However, there is a percentage of these juveniles that, yes, are repeat offenders while they're juveniles, not even as just adults. I don't have those figures, and forgive me for not having them. I wish I did. It's not as small as a percentage you would think, but those individuals are frequent flyers, like the cops like to call them. We see them time and time again through their juvenile lives, and certainly when they become adults, and they just gets more violent when they become adults, becomes far more serious. And it almost seems, in my experience, to see the kids I have seen in and out of jail, or shall I say in and out of detention center, then become adults in and out of jail, when that occurs, it almost seems they get to a point in their lives where they become stuck. They're too involved. They cannot break away. And even if they attempted to get a job, well, now they have a criminal history, and now they can't get that job. Maybe they want to try to get into college. That doesn't work. They have no money for college because they have no job. Perhaps they've started a family, whether they meant to or not, and now they have kids, okay? And so now they're stuck, and what else do you know but the street or the group of people that put you in that spot to begin with? And so now they don't have a choice. It is the quickest way to get money. This is the quickest way to survive. And in my law enforcement career and also as a coach, I would say that the majority of these kids that we're talking about here, it's a matter of survival. I mean, it's one of our instincts in lives, okay, is to survive, shelter, food, and to survive. And so that's the only way they know how to do it. That's why they're repeat offenders. There's a stage in juveniles, and I know Investigator Motorson can vouch for me on this one. There are so many juveniles we contact that are engaged in criminal activity. Why? Well, really, there's a thrill about it. There's a reputation they want to get from it. We call it street creds, okay? But in school or amongst their peers at home in their neighborhoods, they want to be known as someone not to mess with. Well, why? Why would a kid feel that way? I'm telling you right now, it's because survival. They don't want to be picked on. They don't want to be messed with. They want to be respected. They're getting to the age where they're gaining independence. They want to maintain that. And so now they're looking for this reputation, not knowing that later in life it's going to bite them. And certainly we all know, because we were all juveniles at one point, our future really consists of just the 30 minutes in front of us, maybe the week if we're lucky. And so that's why they're making the decisions that they're making. And like I said, they get stuck. Now they're adults, and, okay, let me try to get a job. Let me try to go to school. Wow, this is the hard way to do it, is their mentality. So they go back to what they know easiest, and that's why we have this situation. So, but to answer the question, no, the majority of juveniles arrested aren't quite necessarily repeat offenders as adults, but that percentage that are is definitely giving us a problem. Thank you.
Deputy, a follow-up question, if you will. First-time offenders arrested on alcohol and marijuana charges, do you know the percentages offhand of what that might, what those numbers might be?
I do not. I do not know the percentages offhand, but I will say, and what I can offer you is my experience, no, not quite alcohol and marijuana related, or that they are on drugs at the time of the crimes they commit, because they, again, there's battery charges, theft charges, shoplifting, stealing cars, and there's a lot of other crimes. I will say this, though. The question is whether or not alcohol or marijuana takes part in these kids' decision-making. There are a lot of other drugs I haven't heard mentioned yet. We did talk about ecstasy briefly, which is a mixture of several different drugs. It's considered a hallucinogen, like LSD was when it was popular, more popular than it is now. There is steroid use. And we seem to forget that steroids is a very, very serious, serious problem in high schools, especially amongst men or the boys. They want muscles. They want scholarships. They want the same thing every other kid wants, so they cheat. They do it the wrong way. But I'll tell you, 99.9% of these juveniles taking steroids, in this example, don't know how to take it. They're learning it off the Internet, and everyone knows the Internet is not necessarily the most credible place to go to get the best information. So they're taking steroids in a very harmful way. It's harmful, period, but they're abusing it like they would marijuana or anything else. Heroin is a very popular thing more and more. Heroin, I believe, back, I would say, I don't know, let's say the 60s and 70s and the 80s, was taken, you've seen all the movies and you've heard about it growing up, was all taken through needles. Not any longer. Heroin has been processed in a way where now it's a powder and they snort it like cocaine. It's easier to transport. So, yes, there are juveniles here in Seminole County, I know, I've seen it with my own eyes, are engaging in heroin use, which is super, super dangerous. We know that. We mentioned briefly earlier prescription drugs. They're stealing it from the parents who are on prescription drugs. That will put them into the grave just as fast as marijuana and cocaine will. All right? And then they mix it. They're not satisfied with the high of marijuana. They're not just satisfied with the high of cocaine, so they do them both together. All right, there's something called a speedball, all right, which is heroin and cocaine mixed together. And so there's so many different things. And then we've heard about these kids going to the stores and buying regular household products. That's what crystal meth is made out of, if you've heard that term before. It's a mixture of everywhere from, I don't know, Lysol to hairspray to what have you, huffing paint and all these other things. So Drug use is always a problem in our community. I wouldn't, however, say that it is the root of all of our criminal problems, and not all juveniles who are arrested are on alcohol or marijuana alone.
Thank you, Deputy. Before we hear from Steve Barnes, I mean, start thinking of the questions that you would like to ask our group. Deputy, prosecutor, soil and water conservation guy, I love to say that. Circuit Judge, Deputy Sheriff's Office. So be thinking about questions for them. And so I'm going to ask Steve Barnes to come up now and talk about, if he would, what was most effective in his rehabilitation, in his marijuana use. And then we're going to have a question for all the group here, and then it'll be your turn after that. Steve?
Thank you. This is a difficult subject for me to talk about, as you can imagine. Talking about the indiscretions of my youth is not something that I'm particularly comfortable with, but I wanted to do it because I hope that it might shed a little bit of light on how we can address this issue with our kids. I was every parent's dream probably growing up as a kid, elementary school, A student. As I got into middle school, I started to want to assert my manhood, my independence, and break away from my family, show that I was my own person. One of the ways that I did that was through drug and alcohol use, through running away from home, being disrespectful in school. I was suspended quite often. And at the age of 15, I was arrested on a minor drug charge. By that time, my parents had pretty much had it up to here with me. I wasn't quite as bad as Junior, but I was getting there. And at that time, this is back in 1985, so it's been a few years. If your parents wouldn't take you back once you'd been charged with that, basically your option was to stay at the detention center until your hearing. And so I spent 6 weeks in a juvenile detention facility, and I heard it said that it wasn't jail, but this one was pretty darn close to what you would consider a jail. There are long halls, there are small rooms that are about 10 by 15 or 12 by 15 with two concrete bunks and a toilet in the middle. It was very much a jail to me. At that time, I did become a Christian which I know is not the focus of this, but that was something that was very important to me in turning my life around. My cellmate was a Christian, and we spent a lot of time praying and reading the Bible, and that was something that was very helpful. At the time of my hearing, I had already decided that I wanted to turn my life around, and I was given the option of going to a drug rehabilitation facility, which I did for 6 weeks. It was basically a joke. It was a private facility. I had good insurance at the time through my father, and it was people were using drugs in the drug rehab facility. The doors weren't locked. People could leave if they chose to. Somebody would sound an alarm, but it was really a joke. By that point, I had missed quite a bit of school. I was behind about a year in the credits that I needed to graduate, and I was at a point where I really wanted to turn my life around. But as you've heard before, it's very difficult. Once you get involved in these types of activities and surround yourself with these types of friends, you distance yourself from the positive things. I wasn't playing baseball anymore, which I had done when I was younger. Those kind of friends had fallen away, and I was stuck with this crowd that was really all about getting in trouble. My parents were not convinced that I was ready to turn my life around, and I don't blame them, because I was the one who had lied repeatedly over a period of years, run away from home, caused all kinds of problems, and so I needed to find a place to live, even though I was technically free of the juvenile justice system. I was introduced to a program called Safe Harbor, which is a boys' home in Jacksonville. It's a faith-based program where the kids live on boats that are donated by individuals. The kids learn responsibility by maintaining those boats themselves. They work hard every day. The right to go to school is considered a right and not a guarantee. It's not a right. It's a privilege that you have to earn. They use a point scale, and if you follow the rules and you behave yourself and you're respectful and you do the things you're supposed to do, then you have the opportunity for an education. And we all know that you get more value from something, or you value something more highly if you have to work for it than if it's handed to you. I stayed there for a year and a half until my 18th birthday. And during that time, I was able to earn my high school diploma. I graduated with an A average. It was very difficult, but it was one of the best parts of my life. When I look back on it, it's with fond memories, even though it was difficult. I stay in close contact with Safe Harbor, which recently was made into a film on the Hallmark Channel. You can find that online, I believe. And I understand a couple of the characters were loosely based on my experiences there. So you can check that out loosely. And I may show that one day and invite you guys to come. But the point that I want to make, I think, is twofold. One, we have to have programs that really get involved in these kids' lives, that really disrupt their traditional behavior patterns. You know, putting someone in a detention center for a few weeks, or sending somebody to a quick drug rehab and then putting them back into the same environment with their same friends, is a recipe for repeat offenders in most cases. I was able to get out of this in part because I wasn't around my old friends, because I made new friends and had new accomplishments. And I think that the programs that we should be focusing on are those that really prepare teenagers for adulthood, that teach them skills, that help them with their education, and most importantly, teach them personal responsibility. You know, a lot of teenagers, and especially boys, whether it's sex or drugs or whatever, they see these things as milestones in becoming an adult and breaking away from childhood. They're their own man. But what we have to teach them is that being a man is not about doing drugs or chasing women or whatever it might be. It's taking responsibility for your own actions. And I think that's something that's really been lost in the shuffle. And I think the other most important thing is that we need to catch these kids before they get into trouble. Whether that's through sports programs or church programs or being involved in their community. But there's all this energy out there, and we all know that idle hands, right, do the devil's work. And that's so true. So I have some very good friends who are very smart, some of the most intelligent people you'd ever meet, very energetic, a lot of promise, who ended up spending many of their adult years in prison because they didn't get the help that I got when I was a teenager. So that's why I'm here, and if you have any questions later on, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Steve. This question is for all the panelists to participate in or to participate not, and then we'll open the floor for the remaining moments for all of you for your questions. The question is, do you offer emotional support or family therapy or counseling or any other programs to help these young people not completely lose sight of a good path to be on? Who would like to answer that question? Judge Alley?
The short answer is we try. There has to be a cafeteria plan of choice because no two kids fall into exactly the same category. The Safe Harbor program that he went to, there's a branch of that in Orlando. and some kids actually end up in that program. What we have in Seminole County is very limited, but Orlando has more. We have Jennifer Small here from The Grove, which is one of our major providers, and for juveniles, I think the only drug treatment provider that's residential. They used to have a level 6 DJJ commitment program here, too, but you know what funding did to all of our statewide programs. We also had a level 2 girls program in Sanford, also gone. There's a lot of stuff out there, but we have to have different choices in different programs, and we try to match them. Dawn's going to tell you specifically about one of the ones we use quite often, and it helps us a lot with first-time offenders. I am involved in the drug court program, which is for kids who don't necessarily have a drug charge. They can have Grand Theft Auto, but if we deem it's drug-related, we can give them some drug treatment, which we use The Grove for a lot of that, not just residential, but to go forward. And that's when we involve the families. Once they're sentenced, and we call it disposition in juvenile court because we have to explain to the kids what a disposition is, because they'll say, there's nothing wrong with my disposition. And so we have to explain that that's like a sentencing in adult court. But when we do that disposition, when they've been adjudicated or we even withheld adjudication, we put them on some kind of program. It could be probation with a lot of different things that they have to do. There's standard things like they have to go to school or they have to have a job. They have to get a certain amount of counseling. The parents have to do a certain amount of stuff. But the better programs that we have involving the parents are these alternative programs like drug court and the pay program. Some of the other programs like, what's the one that you started, Vision?
Venture.
Venture program. We also have a really great program that is called Youth Build, where they actually go in and they start building homes and so forth, and so they actually get some trade knowledge as well as a GED when they finish up. A lot of our kids are in GED programs. A lot of them are in adult high school at SCC because it's not working for them. We have the Eugene Gregory Academy out at the airport. Really fulfills a huge bunch of purposes, not only for kids who are on probation who are expelled from the school system, can't go, they can go to the Eugene Gregory Academy and get their education, as well as other components that relate to punishment issues. Or if they've been in a commitment and they're coming out, we offer them some time to get back into the system. One of the things that it's important, and I think your question recognizes, is one of the things we have to deal with juveniles is they're not adults. They do not have all that power over their own selves. They have families and they have systems that they're going to come out of and come right back into the same system that they were in before they committed their crime. So it's something we try to deal with, and we try to give them the tools in these programs to deal with themselves. But almost every program I know deals a little bit with therapy or at least assessment and evaluation to see what kind of therapy they need. And we hope that the parents become involved. And there is actually a sanction we can do occasionally when the parents are adamant about not being helpful. But other than that, we just are trying to encourage parents to be more involved and to be more helpful in their children's rehabilitations. It is rehabilitative with children more than it is punishment. So that is a focus. So I thought I'd start that, and everybody else can chime in on what they do specifically. I think, Dawn, if you want to talk about paper.
I handed out, before we started, a pamphlet on the PAY program. PAY stands for the Prosecution Alternatives for Youth. When cases come into our office, we have a couple different ways we can do it. We can either file on the case and send it through the court system, or we can no-file a case, which means it ends there, we're not going further. Or there's also the Prosecution Alternatives for Youth, the PAY program. Now, that program is used for first-time offenders, some second-time offenders, and a few felonies. For instance, a possession of marijuana charge we could send to the PAY program, or maybe a petty theft charge would go to the PAY program. There are a couple different components to the PAY program. There is teen court, which that pamphlet talks about a little bit, where there are an attorney will be the judge. Otherwise, there are volunteer kids that come from the school system that will be attorneys, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and then the jury. And they volunteer that way from the school system. And are children that don't have charges. They're just doing it maybe for credit or some scholarships, things like that. Most of those petty thefts will go to teen court. The drug type charges will go to what we call the JASP program. And that program is more, it has counseling. They will get counseling at different places. They may do some community service, things like that. But the focus will mainly be the drug counseling. And that's where our first-time offenders will go, into that program to get the counseling. Now, for instance, say they're still using drugs after that program. Then when we send the case to diversion, we do not file on the case. We file what we call a referral to the PAY program. So the case is not filed on. When they finish, if they just complete the PAY program, then we null process the case, means we drop it. So charges were never filed in that case. So it's a wonderful program that juveniles can take advantage of. And it's a very successful program. Most juveniles that go through the PAY program, we don't ever see again. So it's a wonderful program, and it's one of the opportunities that juveniles have to get the help they need. And unfortunately, if some do keep testing positive for their drugs, then we have drug court that they can go to and get more intensive counseling and things like that. Some in drug court may end up in residential. It just totally depends on each child's problem at the time. And we have another diversion program called Venture. That is run by the Sheriff's Office in conjunction with Boys and Girls Club. So that one is limited by age because of the Boys and Girls Club participation. That is limited to 14 and 15-year-olds. And those type of charges we send there, for example, may be a possession of a weapon on school grounds that don't qualify for the PAY program, but where they could go to Venture, because the PAY program is 90 days, give or take. Venture is a year-long program where they do a lot of different things. It's Boys and Girl Scouts. They go camping. They do things like that. And you'll find that some possession of weapons on school property are kids that maybe go hunting on the weekend, and they bring something to school that they shouldn't bring to school. And others are a lot more serious than that, but that might be an example of something that I would send to our Venture program. And I hope that answers the question there.
Thank you. Could you talk about Boys and Girls Town and what they offer in terms of any kind of alternative services other than just for children who have no parents?
Okay. Who would like to? Okay, Judge Alley.
That's not a criminal justice issue, which is why I stood up to answer this question, because this is for the abuse, abandon, neglect children type of things. But they do have a component that deals with DJJ, and that's children in need of services. They offer some counseling for that. That's usually a truancy issue, but not limited to truancy issues. So they have outpatient counseling. They have residential components that they can have for the children. They're counseling the children, so they're not so much into the family component of the counseling. That's usually done through another group, families in need of services kind of thing. But and we call it SINS, Children in Need of Services. I know it's silly, but that's what we call it. It's actually SINS Fence, Children or Families in Need of Services. We have acronyms for everything, and unfortunately we're all going to fall into that, and I apologize for that in advance. If you don't understand what we're saying, please ask. But that is the component that they have. There are other places they can go other than the Boys and Girls Town that we have both in Sanford and in Oviedo and that type of thing. But there is an education component there. There is a family component. There is a responsibility component. We find that a lot of kids with that kind of structure actually flourish in that kind of environment. But as soon as we put them back in their home environment, it all falls apart again. So we see a lot of repeat in the SIN system, because they really need structure and they're not getting it at home.
Thank you, Judge Alley. Next question, please.
First of all, this is just so wonderful to hear all this and to be educated, and I applaud you all for what you do, because it just can't be easy. My question is that when you get people that come before you, whether it's coming into the sheriff's area, the Seminole County Sheriff's Department, whatever, any law enforcement in the courtroom, and you see a child 16 and 17 years old that you know that the family environment is no good to return that child to because there's abuse and issues going on with drugs in the family, what happens to the child 15 and 16, 17 years old? What happens to them? What do you do? And do you do anything to go after the families that are keeping involved in this and keeping this going? I know this is a tough question, but I'm kind of wondering what happens here. Thank you.
Well, guess who's back? Judge Alley.
Although we're all mandatory reporters for dependency issues, and that's a dependency issue, again, not really a criminal justice issue. If a family environment falls to the level of abuse, abandonment, neglect, there's a component of the Sheriff's Department which it goes out and does an investigation if a report is filed. We, as I said, are all mandatory reporters. So if we see something like that, we have to call the hotline and file a fax report to the hotline about what we think is the problem. It gets investigated. If they find sufficient evidence that the child needs to be sheltered or they need to file a petition, it comes back to the court system through the dependency side, which is also juvenile, to deal with those kind of issues. Hopefully, the families in need of services and children in need of services and other there's a ton of voluntary programs out there to deal with that, fortunately. And there's a little more money, frankly, for dealing with intervention in that area because the focus has been to try and get to there before it gets into the court system. And they've been doing a fairly decent job of that. Of course, funding is down on everything now. But we have family education programs, parenting classes that they go to that are funded. They were done by the Salvation Army. Now they're being done by Safe House of Seminole. Those are like 8 to 15-week parenting classes. So there's long-term going on. Their spouse substance abuse program where we test the people. It's just so broad. We were kind of focused on juvenile criminal issues here more than dependency issues. But it is a coordinating issue, and we do, one of the things the court system does is if there's a dependency case and a delinquency case, we assign them to the same judge so that that judge gets to know the family situation as well as just the child situation. They have a community policing scenario where various areas are always the same. So hopefully if the child's going to have a problem more than once, we know it because it's all in the same community and it goes back to the same prosecutor, the same probation officer, etc. So those are some of the things we do to try to head those things off. Those are life-term, we-can't-fix-it problems, but we're not just trying to put a Band-Aid on it. Each kid is, again, its own separate thing, and we try to deal with that one kid at a time rather than globally, because globally, it's not one-size-fits-all. So it has to be dealt with individually with each parent. If we see it, we report it.
So when a child comes before you and you've seen them again and again and you realize it's really coming out of the family home and you can't get the family to cooperate and go under these programs that you would like, what do you do with this child that keeps coming before you?
That's when dependency comes in. And in dependency court, it can be anything from a plan of rehabilitation or reunification with the child. First, we take the child away, assuming it's that bad, and put them with the Department of Children and Family. They might go into foster placement. Most teenagers end up in group homes. So it's kind of like orphanages reversed. They used to be little babies went into orphanages, and when they got older, they went into work groups. It's kind of reversed now. Little babies go into foster homes, and older kids get placed in group homes. But we do that until either the parent has been rehabilitated or it's been so long and they haven't been rehabilitated, we terminate parental rights and put the child up for adoption. Bottom line.
Next question, please.
Yes, we're concerned in reference to the onslaught, if you will, of pharmaceutical drugs. And I just want to ask anyone, have we seen in Seminole County an increase in cross-the-counter pharmaceutical-type drugs versus marijuana and alcohol? Because we've seen some indications that it might be increasing from a school system standpoint, and we just want to know what's happening globally in Seminole County. Thank you.
Okay, first we'll hear from Dawn Courtwright from the State Attorney's Office, and then we'll hear from Dan, pardon me, I know how to pronounce the name, I just can't read the writing, this is my problem. Dan Camargo with the Sheriff's Office.
I'll be quick as far as my response, but as far as cases that come into my office, I've been there in the juvenile division for a little over 9 years. Obviously, I like the juvenile division since I've been there that long. But when I first started, it was more cocaine cases that I would receive. The past couple years, I have barely seen cocaine cases. It has all been oxycodone, for example. It's been prescription drugs. It is coming from everywhere, and I believe it was a judge that mentioned they get it from their parents, that they take it from their parents. Their parents aren't locking it up well enough, and they'll get it from them. And unfortunately, they sell it, too. I mean, a lot of them are taking it. They're not necessarily using it. They're selling it. They want to sell it to get the money for whatever else they want to get, and it's not necessarily drugs. It's whatever they want at the moment that they're trying to sell it. The marijuana cases, that hasn't changed. I get tons of those, had tons of those since I started till now. But as far as the felony type of drugs, it's more prescription now than anything else. So, and I'll let.
Regarding prescription drugs, yes, I think there's an increase. We've come across it more and more in our investigations. Whether we feel at the moment that it's worth an arrest, or just seizing these pharmaceuticals that are in possession by a kid who is not prescribed those pharmaceuticals, and seize them and destroy them, there is an increase. All the pain meds are the first ones to go. Oxycodone or Oxycontin, Percocets, Darvocets, and all of those. Something else too: Xanax, Downers, sleep aids are really big too as well. We had an investigation last year, Investigator Motorson and I, it was a group, it was a gang. They're serving time now. Thankfully, it's where they belonged. I don't mean to sound so rough, but they were causing us a lot of problems out there, and we were listening to the phone calls that these individuals were making to their other members of this group from the jail, and they were saying, hey, listen, we got to get more of those things. Well, those things we determined were oxycodones. And I personally listened to one call where one guy was instructing his girlfriend to visit a certain doctor and fake or over-exaggerate a back injury or back pain just to obtain some of these things. I do know that, and I don't know specifically how they're doing it, but pharmacies around Seminole County have gotten a lot tougher on distributing and how they're prescribing these and how they're getting them out. Not anyone can just pick up a prescription now. When there are certain types, you have to sign, give your Social Security number, your ID number, because there's been so many fraud cases and there's been so many scams of kids and people trying to get these. Not too long ago, I think there was a case here in Sanford. There was a burglary after hours to a pharmacy, and they took over 500, 600 pharmaceutical pills, and they ignored all of the other ones except the pain pills. Those are the ones that they took. So to answer your question, yes, sir.
All right. Out of respect for your time and our panelists' time, we have room for one more question, please.
You've all been very impressive. It sounds like that the county is well covered, and I'm sure you're doing a very good job. However, the drug problem is increasing. It seems to me that Steve was turned around in the jail. Maybe we should say that the jail is also a rehab.
Okay, Judge Alley.
Okay. Last year, the legislature had a massive committee assignment to redo the juvenile justice system. And like I said, we need a cafeteria plan. So some kids are going to be responsive if they're lucky enough to get somebody like Steve's roommate. Okay, that's rare. Okay. But some of them do require commitment facilities, and we have commitment facilities that are specifically designed for drug issues, and they do go to those programs. But there's never, I mean, if we say all kids with drug problems are going to be in detention for 6 weeks, we're not going to fix the problem any better than what we're doing now. There's some kids that might work that way and some that won't. I want Steve to specifically talk about his personal experience there, but there is a move. None of that passed, by the way, because the budget got in the way. And all of it was big budget changes. But there were some good changes in that program that didn't pass, and there were some that we were a little bit worried about, like putting us on a point system where we have to do this and we have to do that. And with kids, the less mandatory and the more flexible, the more we can accommodate that particular kid's situation. Steve, you want to talk about your situation?
I just wanted to clarify that it wasn't the fact that it was a juvenile detention facility that helped me turn my life around. There were some experiences that I had there that helped to push me in the right direction. But the biggest part in helping me to rehabilitate myself actually came later through the Safe Harbor program. That program was very intense. you're expected to follow the rules. A lot of times we have teenagers who don't respect their parents, and especially I think in single-family households where maybe the teenage boy is bigger than his mother. Maybe she can't physically restrain him and make him go to his room or follow the rules. And I think the biggest thing is just teaching kids responsibility, teaching them respect. And I think the programs that work best for those are the boot camp type programs where they actually have to do some work, where they have to earn some privileges. And so I think actually putting kids in jail or juvenile detention facility, if they're a risk to society, if they're putting other people in danger, that's appropriate. But these are breeding grounds for learning new things about crime. And I don't think it's appropriate to put kids in jail if they've been picked up for, say, a single marijuana possession. But I think that there needs to be some harsh punishment that is actually geared toward changing their lifestyle and giving them some direction, giving them some hope. And so that's my thoughts on that.
Todd Motorson with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office.
Just a final thought on that, and before I do that, you know, I just want to recognize Steve one more time. It took an enormous amount of strength to pull those skeletons out of the closet, so that was a good job. You know, the sheriff has a zero-tolerance policy for alcohol and drug-related issues, and I think the reason that that kind of came up, came to light, was, you know, through all the years that I've done this job, interviewed many, many youthful offenders, and I've asked a lot of them. I kind of interview them, try to figure out, you know, why are you at the point you are now? You know, why are you repeating the same offenses? And pretty consistently I get the answer that, and then I ask them, you know, what would have changed, you know, a decision in your life where you took a different fork in your life, maybe a more positive travel? Pretty consistently the answer is, if I would have gotten caught when I first started, that would have woken me up and I wouldn't be where I'm at today. Okay. The other thing, other side of that is talking to parents. What would you have done differently? And pretty consistently I hear, I wouldn't have bailed my son or daughter out, because then the child thinks, Mom and Dad's going to be there. I can continue to do what I want to do. They're going to bail me out. And, you know, I think we need to, it's important to get them into the system, not necessarily jail, but into the system to evaluate them, give them the CAFE, you know, options, gear them towards that individual, what their needs are. And I think that's going to, you know, really help and, you know, identifying who needs what assistance in the community. And, you know, they're our future. And, you know, when you look around, there's a lot of good kids out there, a lot of good programs in Seminole County. There's a lot more programs are going to be coming out through partnerships with the school board, through programs like Operation Right Track with the Sheriff's Office, which is kind of a boot camp scenario that we have on the weekends at the Sheriff's Office, and also through the Attorney General's anti-gang strategy, which Sheriff Esslinger heads in what we call Region 5 for this area. So a lot more things are coming. You know, a lot as we identify issues and needs in the community and for our youth. So, all right.
Before Stephanie closes the program for today, some thank yous, please. Thank you, Todd. We appreciate it very much. Todd Motorson, the Sheriff's Office, Judge Nancy Alley on the circuit bench, Steve Barnes, Dawn Courtwright, Assistant State Attorney, and from the Seminole County Sheriff's Office, Dan Camardo. I have a mental block on your name, Dan. You and I are going to be united for life as a result of that. I appreciate that very much. Thank you to the Seminole County League of Voters, all of you, for putting a phenomenal program of great value on. Thank you, CMF Public Media, for being here today, Stephen Steck, producing, recording, and also putting us on world on the net. So now we'll be global, little Seminole County. We thank you very much. And most thank you, Stephanie, for making this happen. Stephanie Schott. Most importantly, thank each and every one of you, all of you here today, for caring enough about Seminole County to be here. I applaud all of you. Thank you, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you again, everyone, for coming, and thank you, Stephen Steck, and also Pat Graves, for putting this awesome Hot Topics together. Thank you.
This is Deanna Schott, President of the League of Women Voters in Sentinel County. You've been listening to a program presented to you by our League and CMF on teen substance abuse. We encourage you to leave a comment on the website or forward the link to a friend. Please listen for our upcoming programs. On January 13th, we will be having an educational forum, Seminole County Schools Legislative Priorities. Find out how the schools are scurrying for funds to keep enough teachers for our students. And on January 25th, Homeless Students in Seminole County. Our presenter will be Beth Davalos, Families in Transition Liaison for Seminole County Public Schools. We would like to invite you to join the League of Women Voters of Seminole County, which is not for women only, and be a part of educating and advocating for those in our county. You will find us at our website, lwvseminole.org, and on Meetup, where you can join online using PayPal. You may also follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Please feel free to contact us via our website or email at lwvseminole@gmail.com. Thank you, CMF, for your gavel-to-gavel coverage, which allows the listener to decide for themselves what matters. It is our pleasure to partner with you in this venture.
For Carol McKinney Public Media, this is Stephen McKinney Steck. We hope you have enjoyed this first edition of Heard in Central Florida. This portal and CMF's collaboration with the League of Women Voters of Seminole County is another step in CMF's mission to reflect local issues and voices that matter, and to do so in a manner that may not otherwise be available from local mainstream electronic media in a sustained or substantial form. We'd like to learn what you think about Heard in Central Florida and encourage you to leave a comment on the website. And if you know of a local speaking event on an issue you believe is relevant to Central Florida and believe it to be appropriate for this series, let us know that too, won't you? Simply click on the contact link found on the site and tell us about it. And while you're on the site, please subscribe to CMF's e-letter so we may keep you up to date on the programming activities of Carol McKinney Public Media. Likewise, please consider subscribing to the content using the RSS feature we provide for your feed reader or subscribe using iTunes. Once subscribed, you'll be alerted immediately to each new program we post in the Heard in Central Florida series. CMF is a nonprofit, publicly supported charity. Ample information about CMF's budget, governance, history, and future plans may be found in the transparency document drop-down at the top of the homepage. Thanks for listening to Heard in Central Florida. I'm Stephen McKinney Steck.